Rabia Attaya is the founder and CEO of Bait.com, the Middle East's leading job site, which now serves over 26 million professionals and 40,000 employers from its 12 regional offices. He also co-founded GoNabit, the region's first group purchasing site, Infofort, the Middle East's first and leading records management company, and he serves on the board of several Middle Eastern startups. He also serves on the board of Queen Rania Foundation, which is focused on empowering youth through education in our region. He's a graduate of Stanford University with a BS in Electrical Engineering and an MS in Engineering Economic Systems. Welcome to the inaugural Bait Mad Talks Thought Leadership Series. It's a thought leadership series. It's a series to reach your hearts. It's a series to reach your minds. We are now here sitting talking about how people have changed their lives, how people have expanded their businesses, how people have got jobs, and how people have built businesses. The most important thing today is about inspiration, is about authentic storytelling. And we are very fortunate, very lucky to have the infamous, the humble, the very spectacular entrepreneur, Rabia Attaya, who is the CEO of Bait. Welcome, Rabia.
Thank you, Tarek.
Good to see you. Thank you for welcoming us here. What is your why? What drives you? What wakes you up in the morning to turn up at work?
What wakes me up in the morning is I'm actually very excited every morning to come in, one, be around people who I care a lot about and I enjoy the company of. Two, I find every day is a chance to create and to build. So I love the concept of building and I enjoy the opportunity of every day being able to create something new. And I think on a third front, I enjoy in building serving. So I think about to what extent can I use the privileges that I've had to serve others. And I think the combination of these things, whether it's the joy of the people around me or right. The ability to build something new, or the ability to serve the community that I'm in, all inspire me every day to try and do something better.
Going back to your childhood, is there a moment that you can think of that inspired you, a moment that defined you?
I was very lucky to be inspired throughout my childhood. So I grew up in Kuwait. Kuwait was a very comfortable, safe, easy place to grow up. And I grew up, my parents are of Palestinian origin. And that was always a very inspirational community because here was a community of people who were refugees who had come into this country pretty much at its founding and were part of the social fabric and helped build it. And all of them had just the most amazing stories. People who had had to leave their homes at age 8, 9, 10, mm-hmm. and then go off in the world without really anything to their name, and were able in many cases to build wonderful businesses, educational institutions, and generally the community was great at giving back. So every day was a day of inspiration, and there are countless stories I can share with you of just amazing people who really beat the odds and built wonderful things for themselves and their families.
Can you share your grandfather's story from 1948, when sure. Palestine was originally created? What actually happened then?
Sure, so my grandfather, our family comes from the north of Palestine, my father's family, and they're landowners. And they're landowners with a great deal of pride, so they, if you speak to people in our family, the Attaya family were the Mukhtars, which are sort of the village leaders in this little town up north. But with being a landowner and in a place that for a long time had lots of foreign influences coming in and out, there were people who had a massive amount of self-identity and really had a huge amount of self-dependence as they tried to build better lives for themselves. Mm-hmm. And in 1948, basically under threat of violence, my family had all to pick up. So my grandfather, my grandmother, all his brothers and sisters, all their family and the kids. My father was 9 years old at that time, and had to basically run away with hundreds of thousands of other refugees to go to Lebanon at that time in order to seek safety. And regretfully, that was the last time my grandfather saw Palestine, saw his home. In fact, the home still stands. So it's currently it's a museum. It's one of the few standing homes in that village.
Right.
And it's amazing to see people I don't even know at various points in my life have sent me photos of my ancestral home in Palestine, which is in this beautiful picturesque village right at the beach, and to think that they can visit it and I can't, and it's always a sad thing.
It's interesting because I have a similar story. My father moved across in 1947. He was a young officer from India, and he migrated to Pakistan, and at the time, there was nothing really, and basically he came in with nothing.
Yeah. It's a life-changing, and I think it's a multi-generational change in the family. That type of change really affects people, not just that generation, but for many generations to come.
And I feel that sometimes we are a little bit spoiled because we have so much around us, and when we immerse ourselves in our parents and our grandparents' story, that is when the real inspiration comes through. What did your grandfather go through when he was a refugee? He had a family, and you know, how did he move forward from there?
So they went from essentially having a lot to having nothing, to everyone being cooped up as refugees in a single room and with no jobs, no sources of income. All of their assets were left behind, and what I realize is just amazingly wonderful about that generation is, by all accounts, he just got on with it. So I can imagine it's so easy to become depressed, to give up, to really question the meaning of life in situations like that. But he was a man built of stronger stuff, and I think realized that he had a family to take care of. They were a large family, and he had to get on with his life. And so as a landowner, he started looking around for pieces of land that he could caretake on behalf of others, found Lebanese landowners who he essentially was able to strike deals with, where he essentially would grow the crops on the land, would sell it, and then would give them a share of the returns. And that allowed him to at least provide for my father and his siblings. But that being said, I think my father got, again, very fortunately, was on a UN in a UN-sponsored school, and then very early on was able to get scholarships throughout his education. So I guess the combination of my grandfather understanding that he had to get on with it, my dad understanding that education was the only way out, basically meant that my grandfather was able to provide for the family, and my father was able to focus on his education very quickly and really outperform there as a passport to improving his life.
So the core secret sauce at that point in time for your grandfather particularly, and to some extent even your father, was to be very resourceful, because they didn't have anything else.
Yeah.
All they had was that inner drive and that desire to create something.
Sure.
And then they were resourceful. Is that something that you've inherited?
Resourcefulness together with grit.
Yeah.
Grit is the willingness to stand up as you're getting knocked down.
Yeah.
And I think my grandfather had a tremendous amount of grit. And I think that's something that over the years I realize more and more is just a very important part of anyone's success, whether it's his, mine, or anyone I work with.
Sure.
If you give up your battle plans at the first obstacle, you know, you're going to have challenges. Tough things are going to come everyone's way. And then the question is, how do you hold up to them?
So moving genetically forward, because I think those strong genes have been inherited by you. Let's talk about your father just for a few minutes. He focused on education, which that generation did, to give you great universities and opportunities. Tell us a little bit about that and how that influenced and shaped your life.
So I think from my father's perspective, what I was acutely aware of at a young age is my father not only had to take care of us as a family, but also had to take care of a large number of siblings. Families were much larger then. My dad had 10 other siblings, and obviously the age ranges were quite large. And very early on, my grandfather made it clear that my father would have to pitch in. And so my father had an interesting mix of the need to guarantee some form of stable salary to be able to provide for us as well as his greater family, but also this inherent entrepreneurial drive where he wanted to do other things and build his own businesses. And so the way that exhibited itself to us as kids was, while my father had full-term time employment in a large contracting company, he's a civil engineer at the time when this region was being built, he always had a company on the side where he was also working on evenings and weekends. And so it was amazing seeing this man really just work tremendously hard to both guarantee providing for us, but as well as to fulfill his own ambition for himself and the family. And that was interesting seeing him torn between the two.
So both your grandfather and your father basically were entrepreneurial, because as you'd mentioned, a village in South Lebanon is full of entrepreneurs. There are farmers, there are craftsmen,
there fishermen, are whatever fishermen, they are, you generally work for yourself.
Absolutely. So there's no God-given right to get a job.
Yeah.
And today's generation is looking for jobs.
Sure.
And you have created the number one job site.
Yeah.
So do you think that jobs is an inherent human right, and that governments need to deliver jobs to you?
That's a great question. We all need to find ways where we can create value. And whether you're working for yourself or working for someone else, that's a job. It's something you wake up in the morning. If the definition of a job is what you do every day to create value, then entrepreneurship is just a form of a job. Now, I think it's natural that there will be some people who would want to lead, and it's natural that there are other people who enjoy being in a follower position in any form of organization. And that's, I don't know why that is, but that just is. And so I think for us, even those who choose to not be the number one person in organization, within any organization, what's expected of any person at a job today is to be entrepreneurial in mindset. There are very few jobs today that are about just do this task. Today's jobs tend to be a lot more about, in a fast-changing world, is here's a task that we know we need to get done, but there are probably 100 ways that it should change and evolve, and can you help us change and evolve this? And if you don't exhibit that entrepreneurial spirit within your job, you probably won't hold that job for very long in today's world. Yeah. So I think more and more every job is entrepreneurial. And I think just like we went from a world of primarily small businesses and high entrepreneurship to a very corporate, structured world of large businesses, I almost see the pendulum swinging back, and more people all around the world are becoming contractors, freelancers, or when they do take on a full-time job, they really have a contractor freelancer mindset about it.
Yeah. Let's look at your university days a little bit, and then we'll fast forward back into the entrepreneurial space. You're an engineer.
Yeah.
Was that something your mom and dad wanted you to do? Because my mom and dad, you know, for us, if you're not a doctor, accountant, engineer, you do not exist.
Yeah.
So that was really the kind of pressure you had?
No, I have to give a ton of credit to my parents. My parents really gave me, when I think about it, crazy freedom.
Right.
We were not a dictatorial family by any sense. Everything was open to discussion.
Right.
And they treated us as adults from a very young age. And I always pray that I can do the same for my daughters. I just, at this age and now as a parent, I realize how challenging that approach to parenting is. But the reason I chose engineering was I grew up in Kuwait, went to great high schools, and education mattered a lot, but I was very fortunate where grades came really easy. And I don't know why.
You were just very smart.
I don't know if it's smart or I knew how to play the game better, but somehow it just, you know, I graduated as a valedictorian. I had great grades. Right. And when I applied to universities, I was very fortunate to get accepted at all the universities I applied to. And more than anything at university, I wanted to be challenged. Right. And so I arrived at university very naive, obviously, because I was a big fish in a small pond in Kuwait, and suddenly I was in an ocean of genius at the university I was in. And I asked, what's the most challenging major at this university? And the claim was it was electrical engineering. It was one of the largest, in terms of degrees, more people enrolled in that degree at my time than in any other degrees, and it tended to have a very challenging course load. And so I signed up just for the challenge, and challenging it was, so they weren't kidding. Right. Here I was thinking, okay, you know what, challenge, it'll be fun.
You're more of a masochist than being a challenge.
It was highly masochistic, and there were times when I really berated myself for making that choice. But it also, the beauty of electrical engineering at that time was it was cutting edge technology. So what I was doing was learning how to build computers, I was learning about semiconductors. This was an exciting time.
Because you did go to university at a really interesting time, late 80s, early 90s, when the internet was sort of just happening. Yeah. Some of the founders and you know, the icons that we see today were at university at that time, and some of them at Stanford.
Yeah, in fact,
they weren't dropping out, of course.
And in fact, actually, the Herald Tribune once, I remember this distinctly a while back, had an article about the most successful graduating class ever.
Yeah.
And it was my graduating class at Stanford. So there were so many of them that went on, whether it was the founders of Google or the founders of Yahoo or the founders of dozens of other companies that went on to massive success.
So you have a good alumni network.
Yeah, I mean, I was the only failure in that graduating class. So it was really an exciting time. And that university really, I think, challenged everyone. It was very rare that you'd find someone at that university.
I was on the East Coast, and you're the West Coast.
Yeah.
I was at Harvard, and you were at Stanford.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you do is one, you get challenged. And secondly, when you're there, you feel you can walk on water.
Yeah.
You can do anything. Yeah. Did you have that feeling
that you
can go and make a difference in the world? Or was
I perhaps felt I could make a difference in the world, but I wouldn't say that was a byproduct of Stanford. Stanford was a very humbling experience.
Okay.
And for me, again, I was the hamur in the little pond, and suddenly I'm the guppy in this ocean. They were just... I very distinctly remember first day at university, everyone's trying to figure out how they got in there and how everyone else did. And one of the things that happens is everyone starts asking, okay, how did you graduate? What are your SAT scores? And you very quickly learn that everyone else was a valedictorian.
Yes.
Everyone else scored crazy SAT scores. And then, you know, in my starting class, there was a young lady who had already won an Oscar for movies. There was a woman who had won 4 Olympic gold medals in swimming. There was someone who had worked in NASA as a high school student and helped write the software for the shuttle re-entry. I mean, it was
mind-boggling.
Yeah. And here I was, a little kid coming from Kuwait. So it was very humbling. And it remains perhaps, in all of my experiences, perhaps one of the most humbling, because intellectually it taught me that while I thought I was quite smart at high school, it taught me how just there's some people out there who really, I can't even fathom their intellect. And that intellect is over such a broad spectrum of things. So someone could be very, very smart in something, but not necessarily in something else. And seeing that was just wonderful.
Fast forward to universities today, it seems that for good colleges like Stanford and others, most of the people applying have a perfect SAT score and so on. And it's very difficult to now start selecting. And most of them come from India and China.
Yeah.
So they're leaving everybody else behind. How do you feel that we need to balance that perfect scores versus some of the more holistic learning?
Sure.
And how does that fit into a more modern environment?
So it was very interesting. I recently sat in on a talk by a college consultant. And she was saying how at our generation, what mattered was how broad you were. So how many interesting things you had done in your life. Mm-hmm. And she said, today universities think about very angular people. And she went on to define what that means. And she said, basically, universities look to see a story starting at eighth or ninth grade mm-hmm. where you almost specialize at something. So if you like sharks, you know, at age 12, you should have started swimming with the sharks, starting a shark conservation effort yes. somewhere, going to community college to learn about sharks. And while I understand that, they're looking for special people who stand out because yeah. everyone else has perfect scores. The downside of that is it creates, in my mind, people who at too early of an age are having to specialize in things without really understanding mm-hmm. what they enjoy and what they like. And they're having to specialize in it just to get into university. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, I didn't have that pressure, and I'm very thankful for not having right. that pressure. Right. I did what I enjoyed doing.
Yeah.
I did it well because I enjoyed it. Yeah. I wasn't thinking about which college it would get me into, and right. somehow I got into college.
Right.
It's a shame that we're gonna have, or it seems that increasingly people are putting pressure on their 12 and 13 year olds mm-hmm. to conform to a particular set of activities and interests just to get into school.
Yeah. Rabia, staying with the strand of entrepreneurship, you were surrounded by all of these really super smart people, like you said, a very successful graduating class. Can you share with us some stories, some crazy anecdotes from that time, somebody who made 100 million, set up Google or whatever,
sure.
to give us a reference?
There are so many crazy people, but I'll talk about perhaps two of the people who are closest to me. So one of my closest friends was a young gentleman called Steve Ramirez, very gifted, talented golfer, but also just an extremely intelligent young man. And he was recruited into Stanford to both play golf as well as on an AT&T scholarship because of his intellectual capabilities.
Right.
And what was amazing about Steve, and it's always stuck with me, was Steve, even though he was massively talented, thought he had no talent. He really only downplayed his natural skill. Mm-hmm. And he thought the only reason he came to Stanford and the only reason he would succeed was because of his hard work. And this man's grit to this day remains to me just an amazing example of what a human being can and should do. And so he would always work three times as hard as anyone else, even though he didn't need to. Mm-hmm. But just he drove himself day and night to perform at the top of his game. And so that was, it taught me about the value of hard work. And more than anyone else at university, he exemplified that desire to win through working hard. On the perhaps the other side of the spectrum was a young man also in my freshman dorm called Siddhartha Mukherjee. And Siddhartha to this day is perhaps the most intelligent human being I've ever met. So he came from India. My understanding was he graduated top in India, came to Stanford, was already on a scholarship. He was the only person at Stanford who did not seem at all challenged by the educational curriculum. 90% of the time he was bored and he would express that. And as a result of that boredom, he just found creative outlets for himself.
Right.
And so while in the math classes that I took with him, he was so good and would correct the professor so often that the professor refused to write QED, a proof, unless he went back to Siddhartha.
Yeah.
He at some point taught himself the violin freshman year, another time decided to paint a mural on our wall, and it was just a beautiful work of art. And long story short, Siddhartha is now a Pulitzer Prize winner. He's one of the top oncology researchers in the United States, wrote a book called The Emperor of Maladies, which is a book about all we know about cancer.
Yeah.
Was that book quickly went to the top of the New York Times bestseller list mm-hmm. and won a Pulitzer Prize. And so it's not that he was busy enough being an oncologist, right. one of the top in America. He, you know, in his spare time, managed to rattle out a book, and that book made it to, global fame. And so those are just two examples. And they both exemplify different things. One is just pure, raw talent. And that's the type of just intellect that yeah. is so out there, I almost can't fathom it. And the other is, while there's a lot of talent, it's about the the dedication and hard work that it takes to succeed.
So now we're in our mid-1990s. You just graduated. You're out there with, you know, with a fancy degree in your hands.
Yeah.
Did you actually apply for jobs?
Yeah. So, you know, this was always just an amazing thing. So I got a fancy degree. I got relatively good grades. I got good grades. I mean, I worked hard. Also,
you made your parents proud.
I mean, you know, it's funny about that because Stanford wouldn't send grades to parents, and so the first time my dad actually saw my grades was about 3 years ago as I was rifling through some old papers.
Okay.
And he, you know, I picked up my transcript and I said, "Here, Dad, take a look." And he's like, "Wow, you did pretty well." Okay. And I'm like, you know, after all these years, he finally knew what his dollars were spent on. So yes, one of the great things, advantages of the university we were at was there was a lot of college recruiting. A lot of the top companies would come to recruit. And so I had no problems getting my first interviews.
Right.
And long story short, I, within a couple of days, had six almost back-to-back interviews. Mm-hmm. And within 2 weeks of that, got rejection letters from each of them. Okay. And this
was done.
Yeah. This was a massive shock to me. And again, when you talk about humbling experiences, because I thought, hey, I've got great grades. I've gone to a great university. Yeah. I had never really been rejected at anything before, so even my application to universities, I got in. What am I missing here? What's wrong?
Is that what galvanized you into entrepreneurship?
Yeah. I still believe I'm unemployable, but no, that wasn't what... at that stage, it was just I realized I'm missing something, and so raced off to the library to try and learn more, and discovered very quickly that interviewing was a game. Mm-hmm. There were certain rules to that game, and if you followed those rules, you were much more likely to find a job. Right. And so I read up a couple of books and then was fortunate enough to get a whole bunch of additional interviews. Mm-hmm. And now I got an offer every single time. And so here I was, the exact same person mm-hmm. with just a few different skills, mm-hmm. and it made all the difference.
Interesting.
And so that's something I always recount to new graduates who are looking for jobs, mm-hmm. is that knowing what you know isn't sufficient. Your educational background isn't sufficient. There are skills related to how to look for a job, how to apply for a job, mm-hmm. how to interview, that are almost as important as your educational background in helping you get a job.
Is that where the seed of Baith was actually sown?
No. So the seed of Baith came later. So I signed up for a job in an investment bank. What attracted me to that investment bank was it was doing primarily technology deals. It was taking tech companies that had reached a certain level of maturity, either taking them public or helping sell them to other businesses or helping them buy other businesses. And to me, that was just an amazing inflection point. It was the ability to, in my job, sit next to entrepreneurs who are building interesting businesses at the points those businesses were becoming institutionalized.
Yeah.
And so that was my first job, and I did that for a year and a bit. I hated it with a passion. So it sounded like a great idea up front, but I didn't enjoy what I did.
But all of these basically build muscles, intellectual muscles, experience muscles. And a lot of people don't actually, you know, appreciate that sometimes, that each one of these difficult phases is actually making you stronger. Yeah.
And I also repeat this all the time. So one of the best pieces of advice I got at university was a close friend of mine told me that you owe it to yourself to be happy. And the basic underlying rule there is that no one else is responsible for your happiness.
Yeah.
And as a human being, you have to wake up every day and say, what is it that makes me happy? So I found that one of the guiding principles in my life is it's far more difficult to find your passion than it is to avoid the things you dislike. And in avoiding the things you dislike, you find your passions.
Yes.
And so a lot of my journey is about waking up and discovering, I really don't like this in my life right now.
Yes.
And then steering as clear away from it as is humanly possible.
Right.
So investment banking to me was the counter of the asocialness of electrical engineering. In electrical engineering, I was behind a computer the whole time. And in investment banking, I was in front of people. And so I strove to something where I'd be a lot more.
Because I studied accounting and I was really bad at it. But now, 25 years later, actually, accounting and finance is a very relevant and useful skill. And at that time, I absolutely hated it. So I actually understand.
But that muscle is very valuable.
That muscle is extremely valuable. So now moving forward into your entrepreneurial sort of foray into your new projects and so on, what was that moment when you sort of said, enough of this, I'm going to set up my own company and I'm going to be self-sufficient, self-reliant and you know, independent?
So I was working at the investment bank in the US, just disliked most things about what I was doing, and almost the world had conspired to sort of point the finger at Dubai. My college roommate, Stanford, to the best of my knowledge, would accept one person from the Middle East every year. The person who was 1 year younger than me was an Emirati guy. Him and I became best friends and roommates. My father moved to Dubai. My mother followed him, my siblings. So everything sort of pointed to Dubai. And as I was being dissatisfied with my iBanking job, I woke up one day and said, okay, I'm packing up and leaving. I'm moving to Dubai. I came to Dubai, worked with my dad for a year, and my dad isn't about pampering, so so he took me and threw me at every single bad situation he could come up with. Okay. And one of those bad situations was everything from project in the desert that was way behind schedule to when I resolved a lot of that. Him and his partner had been defrauded for tens of millions of dollars. And the company they were involved in Abu Dhabi was falling apart, and there were lawsuits and there were all sorts of things. And as a 22-year-old boy, he threw me at it and said, or 23-year-old boy, go solve it. As I was working with him, I at some point saw that industry and saw inherent issues with it. And again, in the theme of knowing what I don't like, I looked for the anti-business, the anti-construction business. And what I came up with was an industry called records management. Not I came up with, but what I stumbled on was records management. I'm not sure how.
Infofort was the company. Yes.
That's right. Yes. So the problems with construction were payments were always late. You had too many suppliers. You had too many variables going on. It was so difficult to eke out a profit. And so I figured I'd like to be in a business where payments were always on time, where there weren't that many suppliers, where I didn't have that much staff, and where I dealt with basically the most senior executives in organizations as opposed to being in street battles with with various other folks. And so records management is about hard copy document storage, and it is one of the cleanest, tidiest, neatest businesses. It is the cleanest, tidiest, neatest business I've ever stumbled on. And so that's how I stumbled into my entrepreneurial.
And it exists to this day.
InfoFort exists to this day, has been doing phenomenally well, has continued to grow. So that was my first baby, and it was definitely a labor of love and lots of challenges. Wasn't easy. But
you have been a pioneer. Obviously, this was technology, but you have been a pioneer when it comes to the internet rollout in this part of the world. What made you excited about the internet and the platform that was available? Because at that time, it was very, very embryonic. What excited you?
Sure. So again, if I go back, InfoFort was actually not at all technological. It was hard copy document storage. People would produce files. They needed a place to store their files.
Right.
And they needed them for legal and financial reasons. That's why they needed the files. And then they wanted to have these files stored inexpensively and cost effectively and safely.
Yes.
And we were able to provide that. And it was a sort of annuity business. Once you got to a certain number of files on your shelves, you started making money. And then every additional file sort of fell to profitability. And it was a pretty simple business. So once you did it once, replicating it became really easy. So we grew this business out very quickly. And while it satisfied my desire for financial entrepreneurial success, it didn't satisfy my soul, so to speak. And what I didn't feel that I was serving anyone but myself, really,
right,
in that business. There was no real community impact, per se. It was a highly successful financial business, mm-hmm, but I was looking for something more. And in 2000 was the start, really, of the internet in the region.
Yes.
And I realized that there was a real opportunity to leverage the power of the internet to impact the broader community. And that was something I was very excited about.
Right. Because to me, when I look back at the internet in the year 2000, it was an amazing opportunity to disintermediate a lot of industries. The travel industry was one of them. The recruiting industry was another one. Banking was another one in many, many ways. So this intermediation process to disintermediate that and create that aggregation point. So what you were doing is amazing. Yeah. But was it too early? Would you do it if you know what you know now? If you knew it then, yeah, would you still do it?
So you're absolutely right with the disintermediation. And that was the underlying principle that we looked at. We realized that in the region, the single most pressing issue was we had an exploding youth population.
Yeah.
And across the region, that young population was complaining about their inability to find jobs. And that was made more difficult because we have the highest proportion of migrant labor in the world, but yes, we didn't have information flowing freely.
Sure.
Similarly, employers, even though there was all of these young people looking for jobs, employers kept on complaining about their inability to find the right talent. Mm-hmm. And we realized by creating an online marketplace, we can bring both sides together and mm-hmm, opportunity and talent could mix and match much more easily. Now, was it too early? Everything in the world is a bit of a double-edged sword. There's nothing that's entirely good or entirely bad. The challenges of starting back then, a whole bunch of them, one, less than 1% of the population was online. So that was really a challenging time to start an online business. Two, we got together as a team in June of 2000. The dot-com bubble had just burst globally, and dot-coms became known as dot-bombs. So there were dot bombs globally, and in the Middle East there wasn't an internet to speak of, and so that made us even more like a fish out of water. But that being said, the fact that we started so early allowed us to make a lot of mistakes early on, mm-hmm, and allowed us to build a reputation and momentum. So as the internet grew, mm-hmm, we were able to catch on to that. And we were able to get resources relatively inexpensively back then.
Right.
So when I think about what it cost Bait to start in 2000 versus what it would cost Bait to start today, it was a fraction.
Share with us some of your screw-ups, some of your failures, some of your early challenges, if I could call it politely.
Yeah, I mean, so the early challenges, there were lots of early challenges and screw-ups are a bit different. So the early challenges were, where do I get money from? Early challenges were, how do I get incorporated in a region that at that time didn't understand internet businesses and didn't really understand the internet? Early challenges were, how do I get people online? Because the vast majority of people aren't online. It's not like I'm capturing an audience that's already there. I have to find a way to bring them in.
Yeah.
An early challenge was, 90% of the companies we initially called, so we're trying to tell companies, here, you can access talent online, mm-hmm, and the vast majority of companies didn't have online connections and had no interest in getting them. A lot of them thought, hey, this is a distraction from work. Yeah. I would never get an internet connection at work. So those were all challenges. And then from our perspective, we're continually screwing up. I mean, this is part of living. We were continually experimenting and trying to do different things. And where the most painful experiments early on tended to be with partnerships. It's trying to find out with a place like Saudi Arabia, for example, was inaccessible to foreign investors back then, but was a very important partner. Now, when you're young and wet behind the ears, you just want to jump into that market right away, mm-hmm, and get going. And you partner up with anyone who's willing early on just to stick your toe in there. And then you quickly learn that that's probably not the best approach. And if you've partnered up with the wrong person, unpartnering is oftentimes just tremendously painful.
Can you share the the mission of Beit?
Yeah, so our vision, which precedes our mission, is the what got us together as a founding team was we wanted to build a Middle Eastern, we termed it institution. And by institution, we meant a company that was separate from us as individuals. Because having grown up in the region, everything seems to be named, you know, like Ataya and Co. or, you know, Ataya and Brothers, etc. I wanted something that was really had a life of its own,
right,
as a lot of great corporate institutions are have. We wanted to build a Middle Eastern institution that was globally recognized, admired, and respected. And so the Middle Eastern wasn't that we'd only want to serve this region, but we wanted people to understand that we came from this region and that we truly built something that was reflective of what we could be proud of in the region. So that was the vision. The mission is, how do we get to building such a great company? And that was about empowering people with tools and information to build their lifestyle of choice. And the, what that means in very simple terms is we realize the people we admire and respect are the people who've helped us lead better lives. And so we wanted to build a company that helped people lead better lives. And the first problem that we could help solve was perhaps the most important problem that we felt was existed in the region, which was this problem of high youth unemployment that was growing very quickly.
Which is there today, I mean.
Which remains a massive issue and the reason for the Arab Spring and a whole bunch of other things, or one of the key reasons for the Arab Spring.
Do you get a lot of letters of gratitude from people who you've enabled and empowered with jobs? And does that give you that gratification going back to your good old days?
Sure. We do. We get hundreds of feedback emails every day, and a large number of them are people thanking us. But there's also a large number of people who are very frustrated, who say, listen, I've been looking for a job for a very long period of time, and I have yet to find one. And the big challenge is, to a large degree, we're fighting an uphill battle. We're not responsible for creating employment in the region, other than through the people we employ in the company. We're responsible for bringing out the opportunities that are out there and the talent and letting them converse with each other and match. But that means, due to the just overwhelming unemployment issue in the region, a lot of people get very frustrated. They say, hey, you know, I've applied to hundreds of jobs and I continue to be unable to find a job. And that's something I think about a lot, is that while we don't charge job seekers anything and our whole raison d'être is to empower people, and we empower hundreds of thousands of people every year to find jobs, there's still so much more to be done. And it almost feels like, I can imagine if someone is doing, trying to do good or trying to do charity, but has only so much resources, and there's still a long line of other people, it's so difficult to tell everyone else in that line that, you know, there's nothing for you today, please try and come back tomorrow. And so that's part of what we deal with.
Just to put a few metrics in, on the table, you have about 40,000 corporations that are linked to Beit. You have apparently 25 million unique users that come in and connect with you. That's taken a long time to build. That channel to market that you have created, how do you utilize them now with mobile available, apps available, new products coming on board, social media coming on board? So the dynamics must have changed completely from when you started 15 years ago. What do you feel now? What is going on in your life now?
The change is tremendous, and you're absolutely right. And that's what's exciting, to a large degree, why I get excited every morning to wake up and come to the office, is because so much more can be done every day. The very fact that we are a technology platform means we can leverage what's newest and greatest to really serve greater numbers of people. And mindsets, you're absolutely right, change. So I'll give you one clear example. When we started Beit, we surveyed the people who got on the site, and their biggest concern was privacy. And the reason was, back then, if you were found to be looking for a job, not only could your employer terminate you, but they could probably deport you and prevent you from coming back. I mean, if you remember these days, it was absolutely challenging. Right. You were really beholden to a particular employer.
Yeah.
And so we built a tremendous amount of features to allow for different forms of confidentiality. Mm. You know, hide yourself from your current employer, or have your CV public, searchable to employers, but hide your name and your contact details. Or so there were different themes. What then happened is social media changed people's mindsets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Increasingly, people were much more open about every facet of their life, not just their job seeking, but lots of other far more intimate things. And I would say that's almost something that we missed. For the longest time, we maintained this absolute care for the privacy and confidentiality of our users. And then at some point, we just very apologetically almost put a little checkbox on the site and we said, would you be interested in perhaps making your profile public? And public meant it's Google indexable and other people could find you other than subscribed employers. And while we were very apologetic about it, just to give you a case, over 60% of our database now has said we are public.
Wow.
So, you know, what we were really concerned about was no longer a concern for our user base. 2 years ago, we had no mobile users on Bait. Today, over 60% of my traffic is mobile. And that obviously represents a whole bunch of opportunities and challenges that we're excited about.
15 years ago, you were an absolute pioneer.
Yeah.
Today, there are so many sites around and the barrier to entry has dropped.
Yeah.
Do you see that as a challenge? Is that something that is slowing you down or making your day-to-day life more miserable?
No, I think so. With marketplace businesses in general, think of us as a shopping mall, and to a large degree it doesn't really matter if small shopping malls open up everywhere. Shopping malls succeed to a large degree because of size. So when Mall of the Emirates was the biggest shopping mall in Dubai, it became the most successful because it gave the size means the greatest choice for job for the shoppers as well as the shops. Dubai Mall came and that was even bigger, and suddenly it became more successful because it offered even more choice. Now, a whole bunch of additional shopping malls are opening up in Dubai, and some of them are tiny, and some of them... But the reality is, when you look at it, I don't feel they're taking market share away. In fact, the vast majority of the small ones seem to pop up, and then a few years later, shut down. So we're seeing the same in our business. We have such a large marketplace with over 25 million people. So it's not just about the technology, it's about who's there. We have 13 offices across the region serving tens of thousands of employers. That is very difficult to build and takes a lot of time to build. And that isn't really being challenged. Over the years, different people have challenged it, but we've maintained a strong position, we believe.
Let's change gears and get into the more aggressive area of entrepreneurship and startups and VCs and this whole community that we have here. As we were discussing, 100 million people need jobs in this region. You're a number one job site, so you're serving them in one way. But by your own admission, the solution is actually entrepreneurship and starting your own businesses.
Yeah.
Why aren't you in that business?
Yeah.
Or are you in that business?
Yeah, so I'm a big proponent of entrepreneurship in multiple ways. One is whenever I'm invited to speak somewhere or to lobby or to speak to government officials, that's all I talk about. So
okay.
I fundamentally believe that if we're gonna dig ourselves out of the mess that we're in the region, it's very important that we make it far easier for entrepreneurs to become entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean by far easier, there are always obstacles to entrepreneurship, but the obstacles in the region should not be so much higher than they are anywhere else in the world.
Correct.
We should at least have a competitive playing field in terms of letting people who want to start their businesses start their businesses. So one thing is just talking about it all the time to anyone who listens to me. Two is I've always been an active supporter, investor in, incubator of entrepreneurial businesses.
Yeah.
And so Bait has over the years been the foundation, I think, of many other successful stories that have actually sprung out of it. So we, at some point, launched a group buying site out of Bait called GoNabit, mm-hmm. which became one of the first e-commerce exits in the region. At Bait, Mom's World was incubated for a year, and now Mom's World is viewed as a successful e-commerce business that's growing very rapidly and has gotten quite a bit of investor interest. I myself have invested in well over a dozen different internet businesses across the region. We currently incubate a few other internet businesses that aren't Bait. And so I'm in this world, I enjoy this world, I enjoy the world of encouraging people to experiment with new ideas and to grow them. And I think beyond the fact that I feel I'm passionate about what they're trying to build, I feel a responsibility towards it, and I also think that it's sound investing. So I think it checks all the boxes for me.
Do you think the people have the same energy and drive? I mean, they may have a great idea, but do they actually have the resilience and the tenacity to execute and to take it all the way through? Because I see so many good ideas, but I just don't see resilience. Do you share that, or am I being skeptical?
No, I think that's a great point. And I think what you'd want is to converge on a few things. You'd want a great idea with a great person or a great team of people in the right market. And with the right regulatory sort of setup. I see a lot of young people, you're right, coming up with some great ideas, but oftentimes they're not necessarily prepared to build a business. They might be prepared to build a product. Mm-hmm. Building a business is a bit different than building a product. And I think that's something that people can learn.
Sure.
And whether they learn it on the job or whether they learn it going to an MBA somewhere, but it's something they can learn.
So is that that gap, that delta that we have, is it about, can it be bridged through mentoring and nurturing? Can it be built through change of our value system?
Sure.
Not because everybody blames regulation and stuff like that, but that's just one piece. Yeah. You have a product, you can create a business, and you mentioned the word institution several times. Sure. Are people thinking that, or are they just saying, let me get in, let me get a quick exit?
Yeah. So a lot of people are thinking, let me get in, let me get a quick exit. There's a very interesting, I was recently speaking to Anne Habibi, who runs the All World 500. And what Anne did with, I think, Professor Michael Porter of Harvard is they went around various parts of the world and tried to create lists of the fastest growing 500 SMEs in those parts of the world. And after having collated lists in multiple regions, I recently had a conversation. She said there is actually something that ties together practically all of the entrepreneurs who are successful on those lists. So if you look at the top entrepreneurs in those lists, there are a few checks that you can make.
I'd love to hear that too.
How do you tie those people? This is across the region. And so she said, one, they tend to have grown up in the region. Mm. Two, they tend to have gone to leading global educational institutions, generally in the West. So they would have gone to your Harvards, MITs, Stanfords, whatever they are. And then three, they would have gotten 1 to more years of experience with a leading global corporate in that part of the world before moving back. And so
I'm very surprised at that response. Yeah. I'm very surprised.
And I would have that conversation with her. But this is a Harvard professor, and she's also an academic who've done this research.
Yeah.
But I believe it, because to a large degree, it's just about changing frameworks. It's the same talent pool. Mm-hmm. But when you take someone who's grown up in an area which is primarily defined by small and medium-sized businesses, and then you put them in a much larger market and then give them experience in a global company that has truly institutionalized,
It
just changes their understanding of, wow, this is how a business runs.
Right.
This is what a large company looks like. And then that's sort of a benchmark that if you're trying to set up your own business, you can at least aspire to that benchmark.
It's very interesting you're saying that, because a lot of the truly successful people at the moment, whether it's Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs,
are dropouts.
Are dropouts on the one hand. So yeah. This sort of seduction of big universities and big degrees and so on tends to be something that is being questioned in terms of what they're learning at university, not just the degree itself.
But I would say part of that might be market differences. So in their case, they're in a market that's so mature and evolved and so large that if they don't have the right institutional skill sets, they're able to quickly recruit it in. Yeah. And ultimately, even their investors start throwing it at them. So if you're a high school dropout who's starting your own business in Silicon Valley, your venture capital firm will very quickly enforce some discipline on you. They'll they'll send you the right CFO, they'll send you the right chief operating officer to basically babysit you to some degree. And a lot of these guys, the institutional guys, are graduates of those educational systems and those frameworks. In our part of the world, I think the entrepreneur is having to build from the ground up, and many times can't attract that talent, so is having to build it.
No, that's interesting. I would have thought things like writing your vision statement, perhaps staying consistent in a family business. So, for example, in your business environment, you've built Infofort, and then you had Bait, and then all of your businesses have some core competencies that exist in your mother company. And therefore, you're able to utilize those, and therefore you can create more and more businesses on top. So to me, that level of consistency would have been perhaps one of the key areas that I'm surprised, but interesting. I think it's very relevant. We've spoken a lot about the past. We've spoken about entrepreneurship, how you developed your business, how you built an amazing institution. Let's project yourself 10, 15 years from now. Let's go to the year 2025. The world is changing. We've got artificial intelligence, cognitive computing, AR, virtual reality, and all of these things. They're fundamentally changing the way we live. In your context, I go back into the year 2000 when you were dabbling into the internet. Would you be dabbling into AI today? And into cognitive computing, and then let them take over your work and let the robots do the work and have even less jobs?
Yeah. I'm amazed at how quickly things are changing every day. I just came back from a vacation and read a great book about how to learn new things. Mm-hmm. And there was a gentleman talking about how every 30 days you should take on a learning project. Yeah. And so I decided one of my learning projects would be to teach myself the piano, because as a child my parents had tried over and over again, got me all sorts of teachers and failed. I had no interest. And I downloaded an app on my phone, and it's amazing. I'm every day doing an hour of piano lessons with my app, and my app listens to me play and corrects me as I'm playing. So what used to be someone sitting right next to me telling me what I'm doing right or wrong, I now have this program teaching me every step of the way. I'm learning languages on Duolingo, and my daughters are too. And to think, again, that was something that was so difficult to access once upon a time. And I'm not saying it's eliminated human beings entirely, but it's impressive how quickly technologies are able to take on things that were only in the realm of human beings once upon a time. And that has massive implications for my business as a business, but it also has massive implications for humanity as humanity. And I think, you know, given that I'm in the employment space, I definitely am very concerned about how technology, while allowing us a better life, also can displace our productivity. And I actually don't know which jobs are safe in the future.
From all accounts, and what experts are saying at the moment, and the futurists are talking about, is that we are facing a jobless future, a huge jobless future. And it's not as if the jobs will not be replaced, but we need a new social contract that we need to build together about our relationship with the job.
I agree.
And so in this new trend that's coming in, do you feel it's a good time to dive in into new projects related to AI and so on?
Yes, and then the answer is we're always trying as an organization and to experiment with new technologies and what they're capable of. And as an individual, even outside of the BATE framework, I'm always looking for ways to get involved, whether through investment or through learning,
yes,
in new technologies that might change the way we exist.
We as a company are working and collaborating with Cognit, which is IBM Watson joint venture with Mubadala.
Yeah.
And we will be using Cognit as our friend, partner, associate. But the interesting thing about Cognit and part of the way they position themselves is that the internet commoditized and democratized information and content. Artificial intelligence and cognitive computing will democratize expertise. So if you're an oncologist, an oncologist's learning will all go into a Watson artificial intelligence type computer. So while an oncologist is here, that information will go down here. But on the other side, the GP and the nurse and the person who is connecting with you, who will come and hold your hand and say, how are you feeling, Rabia, will suddenly become more important. So the humanity is actually going back up, while the robotics are taking away a lot of the left side of our brain.
Sure.
So it's interesting you talk about playing the piano, because I believe that art and culture and literature and imagination and creativity, those kinds of soft skills will be the main skills in 10, 15 years' time.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the statement you made, the social contract will change. And that could mean lots of different things. One can imagine a world where we are so provided for and resources are so abundant that we all live a life of leisurely bliss.
Yeah.
And one can imagine a world where there are a few who have everything and everyone else is having challenges. And ultimately, this really is about how well we do as humanity in figuring out how we want this technology to play in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
It makes for interesting times. There's a stat that a few years ago I saw that related to the US market at that time, and it basically said that 50% of the graduates of the last 5 years in the United States were either unemployed or underemployed. Unemployed means they don't have a job. Underemployed means they're working in something that doesn't require their degree. For example, a barista in a coffee shop. So what used to be a guarantee almost of a job in my time, you get your 4-year college degree out of the United States, you find a job, now means close to nothing.
Sure.
And that goes back to your jobless time. And that's, you know, I the way I feel this every day is beyond the emails that we get.
Mm-hmm.
We get people knocking our door. You get young, intelligent people who want to build better lives for themselves, mm-hmm. going door to door, knocking, and you see the desperation in their face, just almost begging for an opportunity to make a living and willing to take on any type of position. And that's worrying.
I've actually done that personally.
Yeah.
I have knocked on door after door, and it took me about 300 doors that I knocked
till
I actually got to the door that actually gave me that role and that job. Yeah. This is when I was doing my accountancy in the UK.
Wow. Yeah.
And there were no jobs available. We were not allowed in that position at that point in time. And so to me, it was exactly the same thing. I would just roll up my sleeves and dive in. I have the refugee mentality.
Yeah.
I will go and succeed. I will find a way.
You know, it'll be interesting also from a parenting perspective, even if someone's willing to do it for themselves, how they impart that on their children, that desire, that grit, that willingness to do it. And I feel today also in so many people of our generation, particularly in their region, tend to baby their kids way too much.
I was going to reach your babies and sort of say, you have three beautiful daughters. Yeah. I had the privilege of seeing them a few weeks ago when I was here. What do you give them as daily advice? They're now young, bright girls. Yeah. What do you tell them?
There's so much to tell, and I think also something that I'm learning more and more, and it's something that obviously we're told as kids, it doesn't matter what you tell them, it's always what you do that ultimately is what they take home. But it's, I always try and impart the sense of gratefulness, and that really what they have in their lives is just so fortunate. But when you're the recipient of such fortune, it's no matter what you say, it's difficult to truly understand the depth of it.
Yeah, true.
And so for us as parents, one of the things that we struggle with is how do we teach them that resilience and show them, and not just show them as in a museum piece, but really have them be disciplined by less fortune, because their life isn't always going to be rosy, and it's not going to be always easy. And life has a funny way of having some massive ups and downs.
Indeed.
And one of the parents, I'd like to prepare them.
Indeed. And one of the challenges as a parent, and a lot of parents that I speak to, and I'd like love to hear your perspective, is that the relationship with your children and is actually changing. And if you have a child who's 15 and another child who's 5, for example, the relationship and the journey of the 15-year-old is different to the 5-year-old, because she's already got her iPhone, and the 15-year-old got it at 12.
Yeah.
So she's saying, hang on, Dad, why am I getting it so late? But more than that, the role of a parent is changing in the sense that before you go to Baba for what's the capital of this country, how does this thing work, now you've got Google.
Yeah.
So your relationship is different. How do you deal with that kind of dynamic?
You know, my internal family joke on the Google thing is my second child at age 4 actually came to me one day and said, Baba, what does God look like? And my response was, Dad, I have no idea. Baba, why don't you Google it?
Exactly.
And, you know, that was an interesting conversation about how Google doesn't have all of the answers, but I think the expectation is it does, and it's,
So that obviously changes the dynamic in terms of learning and interaction, but not only as a parent, but as a mentor, and I dare say you are either directly or just by your influence mentoring a lot of people and inspiring a lot of people around you. And that becomes a big responsibility. How do you take that responsibility on yourself?
I think what I find has been valuable for me when people do seek my advice is to try to never share advice, but to try to share personal experiences that relate so people can take their own conclusions. Because no two situations are exactly the same.
Yeah.
And so when someone says, hey, I'm having a challenging time raising money, as opposed to saying this is what you should do, similar to your talk just now about what it took you to find a job, it's far more inspirational for you to say, listen, I knocked on 300 doors before I got one to open for me, than it is to say, go knock on 300 doors.
Yes.
Advice comes cheaply. People I found that interact tend to value personal experience sharing much more.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about sharing your personal experience is you're not making a judgment on someone else's situation.
True.
You're just explaining your interpretation of it and how in your life it's affected you.
Let's fast forward 30, 40 years from today. Let's imagine this is your 80th birthday or close to your 80th birthday, and we are in 2048.
Sure.
100 years after your grandfather became a refugee. And your three beautiful daughters who are now grown up, you're probably a grandfather by then, and they come to you and in this amazing celebration that's going on, and Rabia is sitting there, and they look at you and they ask you, and you ask yourself, what are they celebrating?
Sure.
What have you achieved for them? What is the the legacy, the institution, the environment, the contribution that you have built, that they can be happy and proud of it?
So, tough question. One, for them, I truly want them to be citizens of the world. Mm-hmm. One of my challenges has been, where do I belong to? And I've always belonged to the place that yes. ceases to exist almost. And I really want my children to feel at home mm-hmm. in the world. And hopefully the world is in such a place that that could be possible. Two, I would love for them to be able to say that my father's work has impacted millions of people positively. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, I would love to have been an instigator of positive change for a large number of people, and that would, and of meaningful change.
Yes,
and meaningful positive change. I don't want to make a million people fatter. I want to make a million people happier, healthier, more successful. Yeah. Not a million, but again, a large number of people. And then the third thing is, I certainly want them to always celebrate us as a family.
Right.
So I think. I find, in my experience, a lot of very successful people I've met have telescopic vision. They're able to see what's far away much clearer than what's close. And my family remains a priority. I want to be able, at 80, to still have the joy, the comfort of a very close-knit, integral family. So. You know, I adore the family structure that I'm in, and I certainly would love to grow and nurture that as I would the other aspects of my life.
I have interviewed many, many, many people, Rabia, and the most successful people, and I've asked the same question, they never mention money, ever.
Sure.
Because when you're 80, your values change. What advice do you give to the 25, 30-year-old who's only focused on money? And how do you balance those values between money and building something very special?
Yeah, I think my view of this has always been money is a byproduct of great work. And there was a wonderful quote on this that somehow has just skipped my mind, but I'll capture it before our discussion is over. The quote is actually from Ali ibn Abi Talib, who was the nephew of the Prophet, who said, part of the clause of the statement translated was, "No enterprise can be more successful than goodness." Mm-hmm. And the concept there means that your success comes from being good. Everything falls into place as a result of that. So money is important, but sustainable money happens because you're doing sustainable good. The rest of the money tends to be short-lived and comes at too large of a cost for it to be worthwhile.
Have you got a book inside you that you're writing and that you haven't started yet?
Yeah. So I this is on my bucket list.
Okay.
So we talked about your bucket list a long time ago. I would love to write a book. I think it's something that I would enjoy doing tremendously. My honest challenge with it is I'd like to write something personal, but I don't feel that comfortable broadcasting my personal. So I can almost imagine writing a book for my daughters.
Yes.
That's only for them, and that would come a lot easier to me than writing a book for the world at large.
That's interesting, because I think when you start writing, one of my mentors is Professor Tony Buzan, and he has several times forced me to write. And I said, "Ah, but Tony, it's so difficult." He said, "No, you can speak, you can think, you can write." Yeah. He actually did something, gave me a bit of advice, and he said, "Start talking on your cell phone.
Interesting.
Start recording. That's your book." Right. Because he said, all of the great artists and authors and scientists in the world, he said, writing is like a lump of clay. dump that lump of clay and you can shape it later. What we do as human beings is want to shape it as we're going along. So that's
brilliant advice.
So just capture it, and then suddenly it becomes a book, and then you share it with your daughters, and you don't have to publish it. Books are not there to publish.
How's it coming along for you?
Intermittently. But it's actually taking much, much more shape. I'm actually editing one of his books at this moment in time, and it's Living Intelligently or Death, because you die if you don't live intelligently. Learning Intelligently or Death. Because if you don't learn intelligently in the future, there is no future. And he's written this book with actually Ziad Makhzoomi, and I'm the editor, and I'm shaping it and
that's brilliant.
Designing it, and I'm happy to share some of the insights.
And I think that insight's a very important one, which is the just letting things flow and then editing later.
Absolutely.
I just read a book by the founders of IDEO called Creative Confidence, and a lot of it was about that. Don't fear your creativity. Yeah. Everyone's born creative.
Sure.
Don't try and come out with the perfect product up front. Just produce.
Absolutely.
And later on, you'll be able to pick and choose and fix.
Leonardo da Vinci apparently used to paint about 200 times on the same canvas to get to the final product. Yeah. So that means he just kept on doing it, and another layer, he just to make mistakes. And that's part of
our... That's an amazing insight, yeah.
And so we do that. If we were to make a movie about you...
Yeah, I wouldn't.
I think there's a movie there. If you were to make a movie, what would it be about? And
I actually think my journey hasn't started, so I don't know what it's about yet. I think I don't know how, up until university, obviously, I followed a pretty linear path. It sort of was pretty prescribed. Do well at school, get into a good university, graduate from a good university.
Yes.
And then I think the next steps after that, for me at least, was about making sure I've earned a living and something that could give myself and my family a certain amount of comfort. There is a next stage, and I feel that next stage is really about finding ways to much more proactively contribute. And even though I feel what I'm doing right now is contributive, but I just feel there's much more to do. And so I'd like the journey to be about the contribution, and I'd like the movie to be about that. I think there, so many of the interesting stories of the world are untold because they're not tied to a dollar figure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's wrong. Yeah. I think the stories we tend to aggrandize are those where you can say, hey, this person made X amount of dollars and isn't that great, but every other aspect of their life might not have been interesting.
From my perspective, I think you already have a great story. What I see is an inflection point.
Sure.
And from that inflection point, you can either coast
or
just take off.
And it certainly is. For me, I love challenges. Yeah. And it's certainly
an Arabic proverb that was told to me as a young person that I continue to repeat is something about life being like a bicycle, and if you stop, you fall over. And I certainly feel I'm on this bicycle, and I have no desire to stop. But it's about finding the right inspiration and the things that, again, drive me to just commit 110% of myself. And, you know, inspiration comes from the strangest places. So, you know, as an aside, one thing that I've been, again, very grateful to be able to do over the years is to contribute financially to a whole bunch of different things. And we've contributed time and effort. But so much of that contribution, I do it. But I have no concept of what the impact is.
Sure.
You know, you're told, oh, there was a kindergarten built here, or there are 20 orphans that you've adopted. But really, it doesn't touch that deeply emotionally. A couple of years back, a new school was starting in Jordan. I knew the person who was starting the school. He came to me and he said, Rabi, I'd like you to start a scholarship in the school. And I agreed, and I said basically that my metrics for the scholarship is I'd like an underprivileged Palestinian kid who's at a refugee camp who would not come to the school unless I supported them. And they said, we found a child for you. Do you want anything else? And I said, no, just send me the transcript every year. Do you want him to know who you are? I said, no, I don't want him to know who I am. And interesting enough, this kid went to the school and every year would write this letter to an anonymous, you know, almost dear anonymous, this is where I am in my life, and I'd get a transcript. And senior year at school calls me up and says, Rabia, we really think you should come meet this kid and that he should know who you are. And I'm like, what's going on? They're like, this child came to our school, did not a word of, know a word of English. He will now be graduating as a valedictorian. He's been accepted into Princeton, Yale, MIT. I mean, he's applied to the top 10 universities in the United States, gotten into all 10 of them. All of them have offered him between 90 to 100% scholarships. And you know, the impact of that to me, that one case of just seeing someone go from, and he described this story to me when I met him, where he'd come, he arrived at that school, he would cry himself to sleep every night because everyone seemed to be so privileged. They all spoke English. He came from no privilege, spoke no English, didn't know if he was even going to succeed, and just working his way, having that desire, that need, and then being thankful all the time for this, why is this person
helping
me?
Yes.
And so, you know, my response, and he asked me the question, why are you helping me? And I said, listen, the only reason I'm here today is to make one ask of you, is to play it forward. You're going to go to MIT, you're going to do phenomenally well, you're going to do great in your life. And I asked that in the same way that, again, this was a privilege for me and it was a privilege for you that you continue that privilege on. So there's, you know, while numbers matter, it takes a single story to change someone's life. And in this case, whether it's his life or my life, it's changed both of our lives.
Yes.
And so what I would take a great deal of joy and pride is at age 85, if I'm sitting with my family, and it's not just them, but again, people whose lives
you have
touched. Changed. And again, and it's a two-way street, it really is. Every time something like that happens, it's my life that's equally positively impacted and changes, and it makes me want to strive for more and bigger and better.
And more importantly even, I think your daughters will have cousins, and that's how they will see them. And the impact it will have on their lives and their value system.
And hopefully, this is the old sort of karmic belief almost, that inshallah, if one does good, also good things happen to those that one cares about. And you know, that's certainly my hope.
I think it's been a wonderful journey. We've spoken about 100 years going forward from 1948 to 2048. We've spoken about your life, about your family. Any advice that you'd like to give, like to share with a young person who's one looking for a job? What advice would you give to them that they can take on tomorrow morning do it now?
This goes back to the not giving advice thing. But
exactly.
But again, I'll stay true and I'll talk about my personal experience with this. One thing that helped me was taking personal responsibility. I could have easily blamed my lack of getting a job on them.
Yes.
But I had to, it was my life and I was responsible for it.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, it doesn't help anyone to blame someone else. I think every young person has to wake up every day and think, how am I going to take responsibility for my life and make it better? Two is it is the law of numbers, and you're absolutely right. So I had to apply to a dozen jobs, you know, half a dozen jobs, and get rejected and read a whole bunch of books before I started getting accepted. And I knocked on also dozens of doors for Infofort and for Bait when people mocked me before they finally. I actually remember the first Infofort contract that was signed. The person who signed it, to this day, I mean, he remains a good friend. He signed it out of pity. He saw this suited up kid walking in, sweating, carrying a box. Yeah. And he said, you know, he asked me a few questions. Where did you study? And I said, Stanford. And what, you know, what were you doing before? I was in investment banking. And then he said,
what are you doing?
Why are you here? And I really felt he pitied me. But that pity got me my first contract, and from there the business grew. So I think it's not easy. It's not easy, and I understand that, but it is. Everyone has to wake up every morning and just fight hard.
We've spoken about this side of the equation. The other side of the equation are the employers.
Yeah.
What sort of insights do you have in terms of what should they be looking for? What are the different kinds of skills and the softer skills that are coming in that need to start? They need to start engaging with rather than looking at a boring CV?
It's a brilliant question. I think employers, one, are realizing increasingly that it's not the hard skills that they need, but it is the soft skills. And in survey after survey, when we survey these employers, what they primarily complain about is they're not able to find the soft professional skills that's required for success. I attribute that primarily to the fact that people in the Middle East, while they go to great universities and get the hard skills necessary, they're generally getting their first work experience at age 22 onwards after they've graduated from university.
Yeah, it's true.
So they really have no idea what it's like to actually be in a workplace, and they're entirely unprepared for it. And so employers can play a great role in encouraging people to get into the workplace early by offering internships and summer jobs in order to bring in younger people early on and get to know them. And that's highly beneficial, not just for the job seekers, but it's highly beneficial for the employers. And I'll give you one example. There was a university that set up here relatively recently with an MBA program based out of India, SPJN. But their mindset was highly entrepreneurial. So they came into this market thinking, we really want to make a dent. And one of the first things they did was they did corporate outreach. They'd call up employers and they'd say, listen, we've got great students. Take them on.
Yeah.
Don't pay them anything. Yeah. But as part of the program, we want you to give them work opportunities. So we figured, what do we lose? They're providing us CVs. They're providing us great people. It's free labor. Let's take them on. The first batch, I think we took on 6 people. We tried them for 3 months. We hired all 6 of them.
Right.
And so the fact that we got to know them, they got to know our culture.
Yeah.
We learned about each other with a very low-risk proposition. Yeah. Helped us build a relationship, which then developed into a great hire for us and a great job for them. So,
one of the other major issues in the world today is, and we have been very myopic up to now, but one of the big issues in the world today is an aging population. And Northern Europe is aging, China is aging, and when China starts aging, you'll have 200, 300, 400 old-aged people suddenly out there. Then we have a youth population on this side. Can you visualize something, say 10, 15 years from now, where robotics take over, or in our case, our youth can take over and start connecting electronically, technologically, and create a new world where age doesn't matter? Because the new 70, the 75 today, well, in 75 in 10 years' time, is going to be more like a 50.
Yeah.
In terms of the health and all the health technologies coming in. So aging populations, youthful populations, disconnect. How do we put them together?
Yeah.
And maybe that's a change of contribution that you can make to the emerging world.
Yeah, and I think some of you spoke about the theme of technology helping play a role in bridging that gap. But I also think that we will become increasingly more globalized because of that gap. The acceptance of people flowing more freely across borders has to happen because there will be a need for it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how migration happens throughout history. It's the realization in one particular geography that we're missing a particular demographic that we need. And older people need younger people. It's not just about technology. They need young people for a whole bunch of reasons. And
and indeed, in the world is, and the geography of the world is being redefined in front of our eyes. And in the year 1900, there were about 100 countries. In the year 2000, there were 200 countries. In the year 2100, is likely to be more like 300 countries. The borders are being redrawn and so on. And like you said about your daughters living in a global world, in a global platform. and engaging with that. It's a privilege to talk about your family, about your grandfather from the year 1948 to yourself as a grandfather in 2048. And the journey of your life, of your children, of your company, and all the contributions that you're making. It's a real privilege.
The privilege has been mine, Padraig.
And it's an amazing journey that we have actually embarked on together, which is to inspire young people, to motivate employers, and to go out there and provide little insights and nuggets to people so they can take action tomorrow. And they can change their lives, and they change the lives of people around them. Thank you very much indeed. It's a real privilege,
thank you,
and happy to be working together with you.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. Thank you.